Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Apeel. Apeel is a plant-based protective layer that helps produce last up to twice as long. Learn more at Apeel.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're looking at things that have changed and things that are still in flux. From mothers balancing new lifestyles to the social stigma surrounding pumpkin spice.
You got rid of the star rating system and talked about, like, I'm not going to use the word ethnic when I talk about food.
They recognized that safety was our motivation, and they were very, you know, receptive to the changes, understanding what we were trying to accomplish.
A cupcake or a piece of bacon or a glass of rosé is not inherently gendered.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good evening and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food systems and policy and how they impact all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting on Heritage Radio Network. As the country prepares for a new and much welcomed president to take office in January, I want to take a look back at, well, the damage done to our food and agricultural systems over the past 4 years. Joining me today to unpack the major policy changes we have experienced since Trump took office and the long-term effects they will have on our food system is Lisa Held, senior policy reporter for Civil Eats and a fellow Heritage Radio Network host of the show The Farm Report. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jenna.
So you've been covering all of these issues in great detail for the past 4 years. So nothing is new to you, I would say. But in your recent Civil Eats article, How 4 Years of Trump Reshaped Food and Farming, you put it all down in one place.
Yes.
How'd that feel?
Basically amazing. it was quite the project. I will say it took a while. Like you said, you know, the team at Civil Eats has been covering these policy issues very closely over the 4 years, but you know, there's just so much, and when you go out and try to figure out, okay, how are we going to piece together all of the most significant things that happened, it just ended up being a little bit of a beast of an article, I would say. Yeah. Even though I wasn't doing new interviews, it's not a lot of new information. But we thought it was important to just, you know, going into the election, no matter what happened, just to have kind of a record of the past 4 years and the ways in which the administration has impacted the food system, and just kind of have it all there so that we would remember it, I guess. And like you said, you know, and also be able to think going forward about, you know, no matter who is now we know it's President-elect Joe Biden, but at the time we were thinking, well, regardless, we want to know, like, what impact this will have going forward.
Yeah. And it is such a well-done article, which is one of the many reasons I'm excited to have you on today. It's like,
oh, thank you.
Jam-packed with, you know, with everything you need to know, links to your research, and also just laid out in, like, a very easy-to-digest way. So it's truly just a wonderful, wonderful summary. And in it, you cover you know, everything from labor to farm safety to environmental rollbacks to food insecurity and more. So uh-huh. we're going to get into as much of it as we can in 45 minutes. And I want to start with ag and the environment.
Sure.
So we know.
My favorite.
Yes, I know. I mean, over the past 4 years, the Trump administration, mostly via the EPA, has dismantled major climate policies and rolled back even more rules around clean air, water, wildlife, toxic chemicals, you know, some of those kind of important things. And we don't have time to obviously go into all of them, but like I'm wondering if you can kind of pull out a couple of the scariest rollbacks you know, in your opinion, and just tell us a little bit what happened there. Maybe starting with the dicamba-based weed killers.
Sure. Yeah. So yeah, I think pesticides in general, there have been quite a few rollbacks that have definitely had an impact and will continue to. So dicamba was a big one. It is an herbicide that was found to drift a lot and destroyed millions of acres of farmers' crops all over the country over the last few years because the herbicide was essentially drifting onto fields that were not resistant to it. So a court in, I want to say it was over the summer, maybe July, ruled that essentially the EPA had rushed their approval and had kind of understated the risks of dicamba and said farmers have to stop using it. It's causing too much damage. It's too dangerous. So that happened. And then the EPA said, actually, well, if you still have it, you can keep using it. and people were mad about that. And then they started this process of sort of going over the science again to potentially reauthorize it. And they ended up doing that extremely quickly, and I want to say, sorry, the timing is just tricky because there's so many dates in this article, but very recently, I think in October, basically they did come back and said, okay, actually, everyone can go back to using dicamba-based weed killers for the next 5 years, and which people were just really shocked by because it had done so much damage, and that one, I mean, that was a really big one because it had been in the news a lot. But the other really big rollback on pesticides was on chlorpyrifos. And that was a pesticide that the EPA itself had determined wasn't safe and had banned under the Obama administration. And the Trump administration essentially rolled that back. So that is able to be used now. And similar weakened safeguards for atrazine, another herbicide that is banned in Europe. So yeah, just overall, I would say just tons of deregulation on the use of pesticides has been a theme, an ongoing theme, I would say.
Why? I'm going to probably ask you this question 12,000 times over the course of this interview. Like, why? Why would they do that? I just, you know, these pesticides do things like cause brain damage in children. So, I mean, what's the upside there? Who's lobby? Like, is the lobby that strong, or is the Trump administration just, you know, like, who cares?
Well, I'll give you the answer that they would give. You know, there is definitely a group of people that celebrated these rollbacks, which would be a lot of big agribusiness companies and commodity farmers. And basically the reasoning that the administration would give is, well, farmers need all the tools available to them. And, you know, they often say the science on the risks is exaggerated. You know, even if they're dangerous, it's only if there's a lot, you know, you have really intense exposure at low doses, it's okay. And so basically their whole messaging is always around, we can't take tools away from farmers that they need in order to produce crops at a certain level. But I mean, there's a lot of evidence that this is definitely a business situation decision. Yeah. You know, is the lobby that strong? Yeah, it's insanely strong. These are some of the, you know, biggest companies in the world that are putting pressure on lawmakers, not just, you know, the President Trump, but on like every senator, every representative donating to their campaigns. There's just so much money in agricultural chemicals that it's definitely a factor, if not the factor. And actually, the New York Times documented, there's a link in the article to an investigation they did that drew direct lines between pesticide industry executives in contact with the USDA. So, and that happens, by the way, like under every administration. But I think the Trump administration has made it just kind of like taking it to a new level, basically.
Right. And I mean, any other, would you say, like, kind of any other environmental protections in the name of reducing regulations on farmers that the administration has pushed through that are particularly egregious or potentially long lasting, harder to roll back, the rollback?
Yeah, the other big one was this rule called Waters of the United States. WOTUS is what people
call
it.
Yes.
You know about WOTUS.
Oh, yeah. Nobody liked talking about WOTUS, though. It was always like one of those policies that people, when you would try to get people to talk about it, they'd be like, ugh.
It's like really like
wonky.
It's weird. Exactly. It's hard to explain. It's like, oh, well, it relates to pollution in certain bodies of water. It's just not like an easy sort of concept to talk about. But that was a big, yeah, that the fact that the administration essentially rescinded that rule was a really big deal, and I think will allow for a lot more agricultural pollution in bodies of water. And that's one that I mean, I can't, obviously, I'm just like guessing, but mm-hmm. I could see a Biden administration potentially taking action to roll it back again, re-roll it back. Go back to the other rule. And then I would just say, like, there are a few other things, but just in general, the kind of move away from talking about climate change and the climate crisis as a crucial topic that relates to our food system in all of these, you know, agencies, USDA and EPA, specifically when we talk about the environment, that's a really big deal. Like, it's just been kind of 4 years of that not being a priority. And you and I both know that the climate crisis is real and terrifying. So,
yeah. I mean, that, and you know, literally, like, taking the words climate change away.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I mean, I was at the USDA event. It was last December. I went to it where Sonny Perdue unveiled the agriculture innovation agenda, which was like they were basically saying, we're going to make agriculture in the U.S. more environmentally friendly. We believe in this. And it was actually like kind of incredible to watch him. Like, he talked for like 40 minutes and just totally avoided ever mentioning the planet warming, climate change, climate. Like, it was so obvious that there is a extremely focused effort to just not
say those
words. To take it out of the, yeah, exactly.
Just to say those words. That's unbelievable. That takes effort. It takes a lot of effort from the speech writers. Oh, God.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, kind of in that same vein of, while we're sort of talking a little bit about chemicals, there's been some similar rollbacks as in chemicals relating to food safety, right? And, like, let's be honest, I don't think that the, like, food safety regulations in the U.S., like, in the American food system have ever been particularly our strong suit. but right. It seems like this administration also seemed even less invested in it. Can you tell us, like, what are some of the kind of red flags that you've witnessed over the years?
Yeah, sure. So I haven't covered closely, really, like, the kind of chemicals in food regulation so much. But in this article, I did include mention of, for instance, there's a chemical called perchlorate. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that one right. had some serious science behind it, that it was pretty dangerous, and the FDA denied a petition to ban it in food. And then, I mean, I thought this was, you know, I just found this when I was putting this together. I hadn't heard this before, but I think rather than just chemicals in food, just on the food safety front, the fact that they sort of slowed down enforcement of food safety across the board, which I've covered in terms of, for instance, allowing poultry plants to speed up line speeds, the privatization of inspections at swine slaughterhouses, things like that. But I was surprised to learn that they also, like the FDA, there's numbers that you know, they use this warning letter as a tool to tell companies, hey, you did something wrong and we're sending you this warning letter. If you don't fix it, we're going to come in and we're going to, you know, shut you down. And it's one of their biggest enforcement tools they have to prevent tainted food from getting into the food supply. And in the first 2.5 years of the Trump administration, the number of letters sent by the FDA dropped by about a third compared to that same time period during the Obama administration. So,
and not necessarily because our food, because like it's the system's getting safer.
No, nothing changed. I mean, yeah, nothing changed on that front. I mean, we would know if actually I don't have the number here, but there have been a lot of outbreaks in the last few years, salmonella, and you know, we've all seen all the romaine issues, and there's no evidence that I've seen that things have just gotten so safe that they don't need to send letters anymore. So yeah, just like with the environment stuff, it's just a lot of deregulation. They're just not doing as much to police the industry, essentially.
I think that you write about Mindy Brashears, who is somebody appointed by the administration, and she seems to embody Trump's entire approach to governing, which is someone with no qualifications relevant to the position who stands to financially benefit from her position, especially at the expense of the public. Can you tell us a little bit about who she is and why I think this? Why I think she's the embodiment?
Yeah. So she was installed as the top food safety official, and she was just someone who was really closely aligned with the food industry. Specifically, her research was funded by the National Cattlemen's Association and the National Pork Board. Those are both sort of big food industry organizations that don't really represent, like, you know, your small hog farmer down the road. They represent big industry. So, you know, like you said, it's kind of people who are just coming. I mean, and like, again, I will say, like, this happens in every administration. There's a revolving door between, federal agencies and industry. This is like a long running thing. But I do think, again, it's just an example of how it's more obvious and more pronounced and under Trump. And just like he just took it and really ran with it more.
Right. Like something related to her patents, like how she could benefit off of food contamination, I thought I read. I don't know. It's scary to me. But
yeah.
And also the privatization of meat inspections like that. What would that look like?
I mean, it basically is like allowing companies to use their own inspectors in plants, and you know, and then there's some paperwork they have to file and things like that, but they don't have USDA outside inspectors there all the time, which is really different, right?
So it's kind of like self-regulation in a way.
Yeah, exactly.
It does not work. Okay.
Yeah.
We've seen that before. And then the other thing about in this kind of category that you wrote about was PFAS or PFAS, PFAS, right, in food, the toxic chemical. Can you tell us a little bit about what these are? Like this to me is an issue I've talked about a little bit in the past as it relates to landfills, because I think that is an area that is getting it's like these chemicals are leaching out of the landfills and getting into the water supply. This to me seems like a big ticking time bomb. Did the administration do anything to address this or kind of potentially make this situation more dangerous?
I don't want to say anything that is factually incorrect. To be honest, I don't know a ton about this. We included a mention of it. I know a lot about PFAS, you know, like you said, these chemicals that are from the manufacture of Teflon and other materials that are basically in our water supply and in soil everywhere. All over the country at this point. Yeah, basically everywhere. And so there was, so the thing I know that happened, which we just mentioned briefly in this story, was that the FDA did testing on food. They took samples from the food supply and tested food that Americans eat for these chemicals and found levels that pretty high levels in a lot of the food. But the FDA then determined that they didn't find the levels to be concerning. They essentially said, even though all this food did, we did find it, it's not dangerous. And I mean, I will say, so I don't know, like I said, I don't really know exactly how clear the research is on, you know, what it means to ingest these in food, but I know the environmental working group was not happy with that decision and definitely thought the administration should take a more cautious approach.
Yeah. Okay, so moving on to food and farm labor. This to me seemed to be like one of the most sort of mean-spirited and cruel set of policies aimed at, you know, people working in our food system, which of course are historically marginalized. If I had to summarize it, it had to be, yeah, I don't know. Actually, can you just tell me a little bit about sort of what happened right here? Because my read of the summary was that, like, the administration wants to arrest or deport 8 million undocumented food workers, even though there are not enough U.S. workers who are able and willing to do this kind of work, and at the same time, reduce their wages. Is that about right?
That's actually a really good summary. That was like very direct and clear. Yeah, I mean, I think you're so right, right? There's 8 million undocumented food workers in this country. I mean, the food system literally runs on undocumented labor, the labor of undocumented people. And, you know, that's true whether you're talking about farm workers, meatpacking workers, restaurant workers. Our food system depends on these people. And, you know, Trump, I mean, he ran on a big part of his first campaign was cracking down on immigration, you know, building a wall, used lots of racially coded language during that campaign directed at immigrants. And the administration got into office and sort of immediately started cracking down on undocumented immigrants, which means a lot of them are in the food system. So, you know, it was raids, ICE raids at farms in Vermont and food meatpacking plants in the Midwest, just kind of all over the place. And like you said, while they're cracking down on workers, they're also, cracking down on those workers and then, you know, sort of failing to protect the workers who were then during COVID sent to work in plants where there were, and on farms where there were major outbreaks. And basically the administration said, well, OSHA is just going to kind of stand by and issue guidance and say, yeah, you should provide PPE, you should do these things, but we're not going to enforce it. So as I'm sure many of your listeners know, there's just been really terrible COVID-19 outbreaks at many meatpacking plants and other farms and food businesses. And by the way, those are still, I mean, I get a little bit better now because now the plants have installed some protections because it was so covered in the news and everything, but there's still a lot happening. I mean, we're also right now in this crazy worsening pandemic situation, right? But yeah, so not protecting workers there. And then, right, then also kind of revamping the H-2A guest worker program to, in a way that essentially, there's a whole rule, it's complicated, but at the end of the day, like you said, it is going to lead to lower wages for those guest workers. So it's not a great situation for workers, basically.
Yeah. I mean, doesn't that affect the actual, like, farmers themselves, too? Farmers who overwhelmingly supported Trump? Like, if they can't find – maybe they want to pay their workers less, but if they can't actually find labor – you know, there are all these stories, especially during COVID, of like they didn't have people to like harvest. So there was so much food waste happening like on the farm. So I can't imagine that these policies or that all of these policies would be popular with like a big part of Trump's base.
Yeah, there is. That is kind of complicated. Like I know, like I've talked to many farmers and I've seen interviews with farmers where, you know, they might be Trump supporters, but they depend on undocumented labor. And I mean, I guess I think that's why the administration has been very supportive of keeping and even potentially expanding the guest worker program. You know, they say, okay, we're not going to let undocumented people in, but we're going to send these guest workers and we'll make that program better for the farmer in the, you know, we'll allow you to pay them less and maybe add some flexibility for farmers in. And so that's sort of their way of kind of, I guess, staying on the good side of the farmers because, but still, I mean, that guest worker program, it provides workers for very limited parts of the industry. And I don't know. I don't know what the food system, what would happen if, you know, that kind of crackdown was able to just continue. There's not enough people to do the work. There just aren't. So.
Yeah. Okay. So, and then you mentioned earlier the raising the poultry line, the line speed limits. Is this happening like permanently or where is this like policy and development?
Yeah, sure. So that was a policy that they had been kind of granting waivers to companies to raise the USDA had been granting waivers to companies to allow individual companies to operate at higher speeds. And then it during the pandemic in the spring, they signaled their intention to essentially they put it on the agenda to introduce a permanent rule that would allow all poultry facilities to raise their line speeds. And that was just kind of sitting there until last week, maybe. And apparently now they are trying to move it forward. And the rule has gone to the Office of Management and Budget, which is the agency that just quickly basically assesses the cost of the rule change. And it means that it's probably going to be published for comment like maybe next week, very soon, and they'll try to get it through, essentially finalize it before the end of the Trump administration. So that's what it looks like is going to happen at this point.
That's really great that that's their main focus right now. They're like, we have almost, you know, what will soon be 200,000 cases of COVID, new cases every day, and record unemployment, or like 11 million people unemployed, but like, We really gotta make it harder for meatpacking workers, for poultry line workers. It's so not what we need right now. It's just bad all around. It's a bad decision. Great. Okay.
It's kind of it's crazy that I don't actually know why they would focus on that at this moment in time. It's kind of crazy.
All right. Well, let's talk about food access and school meals because there's more good news here. We'll see. One of my questions would be is kind of like the lasting effects of some of these policy changes. But of course, when thinking about school meals, it's pretty widely understood that the 2010 Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act was really, which worked to, of course, like establish science-based nutrition standards, was super successful. And in like, you know, reducing obesity rates among low-income children. I think that you actually wrote up about this, right?
Yes.
New information that came about this in July. And yet, seems like the USDA has been proposing rollbacks of these standards, like across the board. So can you tell me a little bit about that Harvard study and then what are some of the proposed changes
that we've seen so far, and where are they now?
Sure. So that study you mentioned, came out earlier this year, and it found that the changes that were made to school meal programs, that they really had a significant impact on reducing obesity rates, specifically among low-income children, not so much across the – they didn't find that it did anything negative for the overall population, but that specifically it really significantly reduced obesity among low-income children, which – the researchers said makes sense because a lot of low-income children rely on those meals or eating those meals maybe as two of their meals every single day if you're getting, say, free or reduced price school breakfast and free or reduced price lunch. It's a big portion of your diet, you know, at that point. So good. And actually, the USDA has done its own evaluations of the nutrition standard changes and has found pretty much mostly completely positive results. The USDA under Trump has, sort of came in with the intent to unravel some of those standards with the idea that they're too restrictive for schools to follow, that they kind of place a burden on the food service directors. And there've been about three, I think, separate attempts to roll back a few of the different requirements. One of the big ones was they cut the whole grain requirement from 100 to 50%. They allowed flavored milks back in. The changes had mandated no, strawberry or chocolate milk just because there's too much sugar. Those were allowed back in. So they've just sort of been like throughout the administration introducing new rules. One of the biggest one, the first one, the USDA was sued over it because advocacy groups said this violates the law because, the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act was a law that was passed. And a judge did rule in favor of those groups. And so that particular rollback is technically now invalid, and so that one is not, it's back to the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act standard, but some of the other ones are still in progress. So it's just like a lot of sort of small tweaks that potentially could make the meals less nutritious across the board.
It's like, why? I mean, these changes have been in implemented, and they were, of course, like staged, but like there was a staged process, but this work had been underway for 5 to 7 years prior. And so I know that, like, it's a constant kind of battle between what is feasible for school food service directors, and it takes a while to change procurement practices, but it was happening, quite successfully. And this was just one of those, when I first started reading about it, and they started this work like pretty quickly, right?
It was 2017. The first one,
wasted no time
really quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just one of those. I also, I've done work on school food many, many moons ago. And so it was particularly like triggering for me. Like, what are you doing? Okay, I ask this question. Whatever became of the White House kitchen garden? Do you know? Because I haven't read very much about it. Did that suffer the same fate as a rose garden, or is that still operational?
No, I vaguely remember. That's funny. I did not look at it for this story. So, this is not a factual answer, but I have this vague memory in my brain of, like, right when the Trump administration moved into the White House, of hearing that they, like, plowed it over, like something like that. I don't know if that's true. So.
Yeah. I think that's like further investigation because I don't know either. It just kind of occurred to me today. I'm like, whatever I was reading about, reading up on the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act and Michelle. And I was like, whatever happened to that? Okay. So
So in thinking about anti-hunger programs, like, more broadly, we can, of course, divide it into, like, pre-COVID and now. And it's no secret that Republicans have been aggressively trying to make significant cuts to SNAP, which is, of course, the country's largest and most impactful food assistance program. But how successful has this administration been in this endeavor to really shrink the size of this program prior to the pandemic? And are there any decisions, you know, still pending?
They've been trying since the beginning of the administration to essentially tighten eligibility rules around SNAP and reduce the number of people that are receiving SNAP benefits. And, you know, there was a study that estimated they had these three big changes they proposed that would have resulted in 3.7 million people being removed from the program. But so far, none of those attempts have really, like, set in. The one that was going to – I feel like I forgot. It's hard to keep track of because it has gotten back and forth so many times.
Yeah.
Yeah, this one proposal that was essentially going to tighten the rules for able-bodied, unemployed people, kicking them off. And it was going to kick off 700,000 people. And they got it through, but then they got sued and a judge blocked it. And I don't want to say either way, but it's basically just been back and forth. And so I don't know exactly if, like, any of the attempts to reduce benefits have really been successful at this point. It's just been sort of a fight. They've just been they've just been fighting tooth and nail throughout the administration. And one thing that hasn't happened that a lot of people have been fighting for is since the pandemic, there have been so many calls to just raise SNAP benefits across the board. And the new relief bill that was supposed to move forward that never did was people were really trying to get in a 15% raise in SNAP benefits into that. And the administration and Republicans overall have just really fought against that, even during the pandemic when we all know that food insecurity has risen an incredible amount.
Yeah, and like 15% would probably be a maximum of what, like $20, 20 additional dollars maybe for most people. A month? Is it a month or is it a week?
I'm not sure exactly how the numbers would work out, but
yeah. Not a lot. That's not big of an ask. I feel confident in saying. Okay, so what? But the administration did step in and offer emergency food assistance, right? Because, like you said, we know food insecurity has been at record highs. What has that looked like since the start of the pandemic? And how secure are these emergency assistance feeding programs for, you know, throughout the winter, let's say, when things are looking to get pretty bad again?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the efforts are kind of short term. The Farmers to Families food boxes, which is a big one and has had all kinds of issues along the way. They have distributed more than 100 million boxes. I think they've now extended it through December. I'm not sure if they've extended it through next year yet. But that's just sort of emergency food distribution. And PEBT, which was pandemic EBT for low-income children, that was helpful in some states, but pretty small. I think the biggest thing that actually helped during this time was the USDA did make it easier for schools to continue to feed students for their meals even when they weren't at school, and even in a lot of cases to feed more people beyond just the students. But it's, you know, a lot of advocacy groups have said it kind of showed the fact that there's just a lot of inequality built into the school meal program, and a lot of groups are pushing for universal school meals across the board. And that is one thing the USDA has come out solidly against as a policy, but they did extend it through the end of this school year, so 2021, given the fact that we don't know what school program, you know, we don't know what the school schedule is going to look like essentially even into the spring. So
how were meals being distributed if classes were not in session, were not happening in person?
Mostly grab and go. So, you know, sort of packing up lunches and boxes for families to pick up. Some school districts around the country did delivery. Some used school bus drivers who were not working to deliver the food. Yeah. Yeah. So it just really depended district to district around the country. But it was pretty crazy how people just like, you know, the word now everyone uses pivoted, but these school food service directors basically created entirely new ways to feed the students and families.
Yeah, that is a heartwarming story or development. Okay, so we are going to take a really quick commercial break, but don't go anywhere because we'll be back in just a few minutes.
This episode is brought to you by Appeal. Here at HRN, we care about reducing waste across our food system, from farms to home kitchens. We know that about half the produce we grow ends up in the trash. We all want to enjoy produce at peak freshness and reduce the amount that gets thrown away. That's where Appeal comes in. Appeal is a plant-based protective layer that helps produce last up to twice as long. It's edible, invisible, and imitates how peels naturally protect fruits and vegetables. Because here's the thing, less waste doesn't just mean we're throwing less food away. It also means we waste less water, energy, and other resources that go into growing produce. Appeal works with nature to reduce waste across the food system, from the farm to the kitchen. Appeal helps us conserve our precious resources to ensure we have fresh food to meet our growing need. Appeal, food gone good. Learn more at appeal.com.
The Stone Barn Center for Food and Agriculture will be hosting their annual Young Farmers and Cooks Conference virtually this year on December 8th through 10th. Programming will cover topics like mutual aid, regional grain economies, land management practices, and much, much more. Whether you're a farmer, cook, butcher, miller, preservationist, processor, or anyone else in the food chain, this conference is for you. Learn more at stonebarncenter.org/YFCC.
Okay, and we're back on Eating Matters, where today I am speaking with Lisa Held, Senior Policy Reporter for Civil Eats, about her recent article, How 4 Years of Trump Reshaped Food and Farming. All right, so I have kind of some summary questions, if you will, Lisa.
Sure.
The first is, have there been any positive developments, anything whatsoever that has happened over the past 4 years with our food system policy that is moving in the right direction?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question because, you know, my job as a journalist isn't to make judgments about what's positive and negative, but is really just to lay out what happened. And I will, like, to clarify this story, you know, we went into with, like, we're just going to lay out everything this administration did. And it was in no means like an attempt to show all these negative things. But I think for people in, you know, there are places where I'll say this is negative, which is like in places where it's not political, where like climate change, that's if you're, you know, if there are policies that are ignoring science on climate, that's just theoretically bad for everyone on the planet. Not theoretically, definitely bad. but I mean, I think there are people who would say a lot of this is positive depending on their point of view and who they are and where they are.
They probably don't listen to this show. So maybe,
yeah,
I should have said,
you know,
our listeners are my show. Is there anything positive? No, I mean, I totally, you're like, I'm a professional journalist. Thank you. And I report the facts, which is great.
as you should. Anything maybe that, like, you know, people who are not fans. So to rephrase, anything people who are not fans of the administration's, most administration's policies, let's say, anything that they have, you know, there has maybe been alignment on, like bipartisan support of, or anything that, like, Trump naysayers have reversed course on and been like, good job on that one thing.
One thing I will say, the USDA did, I mean, they were kind of required to do it, but they moved forward a big rule on organic agriculture that is designed to prevent fraud in the organic industry, which is really huge and affects a lot of organic farmers, especially the smallest organic farmers. So that's a big deal, and that will probably have long-lasting impacts on hopefully really creating an industry that is a little more fair in organic.
What about you wrote about the consolidation that Trump has spoken out about, consolidation in the meat industry. And it seems like the DOJ has kind of gone after price fixing in the poultry industry, which to me seems like a good thing.
Yeah, for sure. I don't know. So he spoke out against it. Nothing ever really came of that. And I think the vast majority of the Trump administration's policies have aligned with the biggest corporate consolidated companies. So I want to make that clear. But yes, the DOJ has continued to do their work throughout this administration. Whether or not the administration is on board with it or not, I'm not even sure. But they've been prosecuting price fixing in poultry, and that's a really huge deal. I think there's like a dozen, something like a dozen executives who are now being prosecuted. So
yeah,
that is, yeah, definitely.
Well, that was one thing. It was like they're, you know, kind of the issue is like also, you know, obviously farmers' wages were being dropped, but then also the administration rolled back protections for when they dissolved GPSA, which
right.
Which I was like, I don't understand, because I'm pretty sure that office. Well, you tell us, what was GPSA doing, and how is that contradictory?
Well, yeah, that was an office that is supposed to essentially regulate anti-competitive behavior and, you know, practices that essentially make it easy for corporations to take advantage of farmers. And, you know, this office is supposed to protect farmers from those predatory actions, and they moved the office to a place where it would have less power, essentially, and then they overturned new rules that were supposed to really give that agency more power. They just got rid of them. So that's one example of how, okay, he can say maybe the president gave some lip service to consolidation and we need to protect our farmers. But when it came to policy, that's not really what they've done.
Actually happened. They're all over the place.
Yeah.
Really. So many of the issues that we've discussed were really thrown into the spotlight because of COVID, which of course was laid bare a lot of these major challenges to our food system. Do you think that, and I don't love the word silver lining, but kind of, do you think that this could have been a sort of like positive development or silver lining, this drawing attention to issues that previously haven't dominated the news cycles? And do you think anything positive policy-wise could come from it?
Well, I think you're definitely right in that more people than ever, because of the pandemic, are paying attention to the food system in new ways. I mean, the crazy example is, you know, I've been covering these issues at Civil Eats for a very long time. Civil Eats has been covering issues like consolidation in meatpacking and, you know, the the challenges that farm workers and other food workers face, and, you know, inequality and justice, all these things in food, and nobody has cared about them for a very long time.
Yeah.
And that, you know, and then the pandemic came and we saw supply chains fall apart and workers are getting sick, and then suddenly all of like the mainstream media outlets have been covering this stuff. And so there's definitely just more attention, and that is that's absolutely hands down a good thing that more people are seeing and understanding where their food comes from. I don't know if it'll really have an effect. I hope it leads to people thinking more critically about policies that will establish a system that's more resilient in the future and more equal, equitable. I don't know if that'll happen. There have been issues before, you know, there have been moments before where things have happened like this, but maybe not as much as this. Like, this pandemic is pretty unprecedented, so
yeah,
we'll see, I guess.
Time will tell. Mm-hmm. Okay, so last question for you. What is something you're going to be keeping your eye on closely in the coming weeks or months from a policy perspective?
Wow. I have like many things.
I'm asking yourself. Help me scoop you. Or
whatever. I mean, I think everyone in this space is looking at what a Biden administration is going to do right away, especially on climate change. And I think in my world, I'd be, you know, looking specifically at like what that looks like for climate and agriculture policy. And there's a lot of debate the fact that climate is at the top of his agenda is, you know, established and exciting, but mm-hmm. the ways that will play out in the agriculture and food space are less clear. So that's going to be a really big thing that we'll be following. You know, is it going to be carbon markets? Is he going to sort of bring the smaller farm organizations that represent kind of the more alternative farms and less of the corporate players into the conversation, things like that, just as the change in power transition happens. I'll definitely be paying attention to that.
Great. All right. Well, last question, where can readers go to learn to follow your work?
Sure. Best place is civileats.com. I have a story usually about one a week there. That's my main publication. And you could also follow me on Instagram. My handle is Lisa Elaine H.
Awesome.
Or Twitter, I guess. It's the same.
And Twitter. There you go. I also wanted to put in a plug to support food journalism. I saw that Civil Eats is now, for a limited time, offering a pay what you can membership option for access to your content. Did I get that right, Lisa?
Yes. I don't have like the numbers off the top of my head, but definitely go to civileats.com, and there are many ways to subscribe. And you also just get a certain number of free articles a month, even if you're not subscribed. But yeah, I would encourage people to subscribe and to look into that pay what you can model.
Yeah. Always important to support food journalism.
Thank you.
yeah. Okay, Lisa, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show. This was great.
Thank you for having me, Jenna.
I also want to give a big thanks to our sponsor. Our show engineer is Matt Patterson, and music is by Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the HRN website or as a podcast wherever they're found. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe. I'm Jenna Liut, and thanks for listening.
Eating Matters is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right-hand side of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.